say a specific thank you to Dan Martin, who covered for me for 2 weeks in a row. That is a much bigger gift than some of you may know, to be able to leave and have things in good hands, and I do appreciate that. We were able to be part of things last week and to see the quality of the teaching that you have when I'm gone. We're hoping that that will always be the case, but it certainly was with Dan, and I do thank you. If you've not been part of us for a regular time, let me try to catch you up on where we are. We are walking through the Bible a little at a time. The first time we did this in this class, which was over 20 years ago, it took us 18 months. The second time took 3 years. The third time took 9 years. So we're figuring 27 is what we're looking at this time. There's a sort of exponential growth here. In any event, we've made it to 2 Samuel, and we're looking at chapter 13. We've made it to 2 Samuel. We're looking at chapter 13. I want to pause for just a minute and give you a little bit of a running start to this. In chapter 11 and 12, we've seen the story of David and Bathsheba. David's sin with Bathsheba that caused her to be pregnant. David's attempts to fix that by having Uriah come back from the wars, but Uriah wouldn't spend any time with his wife because he said soldiers in the fields couldn't do that. So David ended up having him killed in battle. Nathan the prophet then approached David first with a story, and then when David condemned the right person in that story, Nathan said, "The person you've just condemned is yourself." And the outcome of that was that the child was born, but the child did not live more than just a few days. And that has just taken place in the tail end of chapter 12. You may remember that in David's reaction to the death of the child, his reaction caught everybody around him by surprise. His advisors, his counselors, his military people had seen him go into deep grief, praying constantly to the Lord that the child would live, refused food, refused sleep. And then when the child died, they said, "We can't even tell him the child is dead. Look at what he's done while the child was dying. What's he going to do now?" When David found out the child was dead, he then got up, cleaned himself up, and went back to work. And they said, "Wait a minute, what's this?" And David said, "As long as the child hadn't died, who knew? God might relent. But now God has spoken, and I have to accept what God has said." I want you to keep flagging the places where David's reactions and David's actions are different from what the people around him seem to have expected from him. And that was one more. The tail end of chapter 12 starts in verse 26. Remember that chapter 11 began with, at the time when kings would normally go to war, David didn't. So Joab has been out in the field. He's been battling the Ammonites. Chapter 26 tells you that he was assaulting a particular place. What's that place called? There's Stratford-on-Avon, where Shakespeare is said to have written his plays, right? This one is called Rabbah of the Ammonites. Do you see that in verse 26 of chapter 12? Everybody see that? What does it say immediately after? What does it tell you about that town? It was the capital city. It was the royal city. Different translations read it different ways. And he was getting ready to capture that. Now, just paraphrasing the next few verses, he sends word back to David and says, "Get yourself out here. We're about to capture the capital of Ammon. We're about to put Ammon down, and you're not here. If you're not here, the glory is going to go to me, and that's not what a king wants. The king wants to have the glory for conquering go to the king. So get yourself out here." And David did. Okay? Now, I want you to put a flag next to the name of that town. One more time. Verse 26. What's the name of that place? Rabbah of the Ammonites. Is that what it says in your translation? Okay? I want you to flag that, because the name of that town is going to pop up much, much later in our reading. And when it does, I want you to have the moment of remembering. What happened to this town? It was captured or conquered by Joab's army, and David was there on its defeat. Okay? Now, I'm not going to say anything more except just flag that as you go along. Right? Now, Let's come down to chapter 13. If you want a title for what's happening in chapter 13, it is, "And now they're going to all fall off the cliff."
Right.
Or, "Now the disasters come." Take your choice how you word it. All of the troubles that David has been spared for the last little while suddenly come. And we're going to see those troubles, and we're going to try to take a deep look at what's going on. I need to tell you on the outset, I didn't do this in the first hour because I kept hoping maybe something would pop up during the hour. There isn't much of theological significance in what we're going to see today. But these are very important backdrops, backgrounds for things that are coming in the next few weeks. So we're trying to get a sense of sort of the lay of the land. So let's see where we are. The first thing it says in my translation, chapter 13, verse 1, mine says, "After this, the following events took place." Now, I don't know how yours reads. We went through about six translations in the first hour, and they all read more or less the same way, but not exactly. One translation said, "And it then took place that," or something like that. I don't know how yours reads it. Mm-hmm. So all this is, the picture I have is that this has receded a bit into the consciousness of the country. You know how sometimes a story pops up and it stays around and then it slowly drops back out as something else comes in. All this stuff of David and Bathsheba, the death of the child, all this is, I think, fading away. And it takes a little bit of time to do that, so I don't know how much time has gone by. But after this, here's what happened. Who's the first person you meet?
Absalom.
What does it say about Absalom? What does it say about him? Son of David. So this is one of David's sons. And what does it say now about Absalom beyond that? He had a sister, and it specifically mentions he had a beautiful sister. Did he have sisters who weren't beautiful? We don't know. Did he have other beautiful sisters? It doesn't sound like it. Although it does say a beautiful sister, so maybe he had other. Yeah, he said a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, that had been another beautiful sister whose name was Gertrude or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, he had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. Who's the next person you see after Absalom and Tamar? Amnon. Now, he just battled the Ammonites, A-M-M-O-N, right? This is now Amnon, A-M-N-O-N. So this is a person's name. And what does it say about Amnon? He's the son of David. So these guys are brothers, right? No. They are half-brothers. Okay? Everybody okay? Which one's firstborn? Trick question.
Which one's what?
Which one's firstborn? Trick question.
Both
of them were. The first six sons of David had six mamas. Okay? So, which was the firstborn? Firstborn? That was Amnon. Where was Absalom in the list? He was thirdborn. Who was Amnon's mama? I think it was Abigail. That you may remember the nice little story about Nabal and all that kind of stuff, right? Okay, so where was Absalom in the list? Now, the list is back in the earlier part of this chapter, chapter 3 or chapter 4. Six sons were born to David in Hebron, it says, and it lists them, and Absalom is listed number 3. So far, okay? All right, that's verse 1. We're introduced to Absalom, Tamar, and Amnon. I'm not going to let you go any further until we talk about this. Other than naming the children who were born to David, how much do we know about the children at this point, before chapter 13 starts? The answer is nothing. What does that tell you? It doesn't tell you anything, but it implies something. What does it imply? David didn't have much to do with his children. David's off doing other things, including Bathsheba. And I sort of mean that to make you chuckle, but I also mean that for seriously. There's not much evidence that he was paying any attention to the children except he had them. And he seemed to have a whole bunch of women that he was interacting with, so he was doing that. But you know, they're there and suddenly they're just gone, right? So here they are. The kids are grown up. Absalom's a man. Amnon's a man. Tamar's a woman. Okay? Now, tail end of verse 2, of verse 1. We've met Absalom, we've met Tamar, we've met Amnon, he's the son of David, but there's three or four or five or six more words. What does it tell you? Verse 1 of chapter 13, Amnon, son of David, fell madly in love with her, meaning Tamar.
He was obsessed.
Now, that's the next verse. The next verse, I think, says it better. My chapter, my verse 2 says obsessed. What does yours say?
Obsessed.
Tormented. I think that's a good word.
Distressed.
Distressed, not as good, but still in the ballpark.
Frustrated,
very good word. Obsessed, frustrated, tormented, distressed, vexed. I still think obsessed and tormented are maybe the top two, but what was the one that you, what was the one somebody said just now?
Sick, named self sick.
Frustrated to the point.
Frustrated, yeah. Now, ours says he became ill, but there's two or three translations that say something else.
He made
himself ill. Right? There's some translation. He made himself sick over this girl. Now, in the first verse it says he fell in love with her. Your translation said fell madly in love with her. The next verse uses the word obsession, tormented, distressed, frustrated. Does that sound like love? My mother, I heard her say this one time. Something happened in our town. And her comment was, he's not in love with her, he's in lust with her. And the clues are here. The clues are here. What kind of a story are we about to read? Sordid. As stories go, this is not going to be a pretty one. Okay? Amnon was so obsessed with his sister Tamar that, he was so obsessed, so frustrated, so tormented, so vexed, that it made him ill, or he made himself ill. Since she was a virgin, and Amnon thought it was impossible, the words are awful here, to do anything with her. Horrible words, but I think accurate for the context. Verse 3 in my translation starts with the word but. Yours have that?
Yeah.
But he had a friend. He had a friend. What's the friend's name?
Jonadab.
We're going to agree today that it's Jonadab. It could be Jonadab. It could be Jonadab. It could be Jonadab. But today we're going to call it Jonadab. Everybody okay? He had a friend, Jonadab. Is the word friend an accurate word?
Cousin.
If you keep reading just a moment, what is it? He's first cousin. My wife has double first cousins. What does that mean? Her daddy's sister married her mama's brother. Double first cousin. Boy, do they look alike. So, this was a cousin, a first cousin. But he's identified as a friend. What does it imply? Cousins might not know each other. Friends do. And the word friend means what? He's close enough that he can give some advice. Now, I would like for you to flag Jonadab. What have we flagged so far? Rabbah of the Ammonites. A particular city in a particular country that David and his army have conquered. Right? What's the second thing we're flagging? Jonadab, who was?
Nephew
of David, cousin of Amnon. What does it say about Jonadab besides his ancestry? Jonadab was, mine says, a very shrewd man. What does yours say? Crafty.
Streetwise.
Crafty, shrewd, streetwise, any other word?
Clever
is a more neutral word, and I'd like you to hold on to crafty and shrewd, which have a shade of the illicit in them.
Is it the same word that it describes the serpent in Genesis 3:1?
I think so.
It's subtle and crafty.
I think so, yeah. I'm glad somebody noticed. Nobody noticed that the first hour. I was waiting for it. Yeah. And what does Jonadab do? What's Amnon's problem? He thinks he's in love with this beautiful girl. He thinks there's nothing he can do about it. And what does Jonadab do? Here's something he can do. He gives him a plan. Now, let's move through the plan quickly because it's spectacularly ugly. He says, look, you're already acting like you're sick. You're making yourself sick. Just carry it a little further. Act like you're really sick. Tell the king when the king comes to visit you that the only thing that's going to help you is for Tamar to come and cook for you. And then it goes on to say that when Tamar comes and cooks for him, he throws out all the servants, and what does he do? Forces himself upon her. But just before he does that, verse 11, as she was offering the food to him, they're alone now, he caught hold of her and said, come to bed with me, sister. And she replied, I'm not verse 12, no, brother, do not force me. This is no way to behave in Israel. Do not do anything so disgraceful. Wherever should I go? I should be marked with this shame while you would be disgraced in Israel. Why not go and speak to the king? He would not refuse to give me to you. But he would not listen to her. He overpowered her. He raped her. Verse 15 is one of the most stunning verses you'll ever find in the Bible. And unfortunately, in the little I've observed of human behavior, it rings true. The moment he had finished, what happens? All of that he thought was love is proven not to have been, because if it were love, it wouldn't have gone away. It gets replaced immediately with what?
Hatred.
Mine says hatred. Does yours have any other word? What does it say? What does it say about the quality of that hatred? He hated her with a hatred that was greater than the love with which he had loved her in the past. Get up and go, he said. She said, no, brother, to send me away would be worse than what you've already done. And for the second time, but he would not listen to her. He called his personal servant, saying to him, I didn't read this in the first hour, it's so ugly. Rid me of, you can hear the venom, this woman. Throw her out and bolt the door behind her. She was wearing a magnificent dress, for this is what the king's unmarried daughters wore in days gone by. The servant put her out, bolted the door behind her. She threw dust on her head, tore the magnificent dress she was wearing, laid her hand on her head, and went away crying aloud as she wept. Her brother Absalom said to her, what would have been the context? She would have come back home because she was living in Absalom's house. Her brother Absalom said to her, what does he say? Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? What does he not say? Have you been with your brother Amnon? Very interesting, the order of those two words. Those of you who know something about language will realize there are, it's saying something slightly different.
Has your brother Amnon had his way with you?
That's the implication of those words. Yeah, you're in the message, and so that would say it more cleanly. So what's Absalom's advice?
Be quiet in the meantime.
Be quiet.
Mine says, sister, be quiet. Does yours add anything to that?
He's your brother.
Don't take it so seriously.
Don't take it to heart.
Mine says don't take the matter to heart. That's true. Be quiet, he's your brother, do not take the matter to heart. Tamar, however, what does the word however mean in that context? She's not listening to Absalom.
No.
She went back to her brother Absalom's house, inconsolable. Verse 21.
What happens here?
When David hears the story, is that what it says? No, that is not what it says. What does it say?
When
he heard the whole story, mine says, when he heard all of this, one translation said. Yours says
all these things.
And I emphasize the word all. Translations that are saying the whole story means he's heard every piece of this. What was his response?
He was angry.
He was angry.
At what?
At what had happened. But he wouldn't do anything about it.
He was angry that this had happened.
All this. He had not the son.
Because it immediately says,
refused to punish him.
He had no wish to harm his son Amnon, whom he loved, because he was his firstborn. I know that it doesn't say firstborn twice, but it sort of needs to sort of clear the space. Yeah.
What did Amnon want? It was handed to him, and he just... Is that just the true nature of what he was, or just... What I'm not going to understand why he flipped at that moment.
All I can say is I read the newspapers, and that seems to happen. It wasn't love in the first place, is what I'm saying. And when that was provided, I don't know, because that it requires a trained psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there's something about you want something and you know it's not right. When you get it, you then start to say, now it's going to do something to me and I don't want that, so you start to push back. I don't, yeah, I see the word projection is a good one. I wasn't getting that word. He's projecting something on her of the guilt and the consequence and all of this. I think that's what psychologists and psychiatrists would say. But what I'm saying is what you're seeing is very... this is tragic, it is awful, and it should be condemned. But this is a very human thing for men to do.
Just like he wasn't thinking it all the way through?
Well, he wasn't thinking anything through. He says he was in love with her, but obsession and... frustration and all these other words, torment, that's not part of it. Yeah.
He thought that he was in love with her. Could it be that she didn't return the love that he had to take what he did with her?
I don't think so, because if you back up and say, look, don't do this.
Yeah.
Ask the king, he'll give them. They allowed cousins to marry. Or even half brothers, half sisters to marry. It wasn't all that. It wasn't licit exactly, but it wasn't exactly illicit either. Can I invent the word licit and have it work in this context? There's a gray area there, and Tamar knows that. Okay.
We use this story in True Love Waits.
You ought to.
We do.
It goes to the heart.
Yeah, because we ask, in fact, this section is called What is True Love in True Love Waits program. And we tell that story, and then we sort of debrief it with very pointed questions. Did Amnon really loved Tamar? First of all, I tell you, when you tell this to high school kids, they a lot of things are frivolous and laughing, but when we get to this story, I mean, you can see how God uses this, because we ask him, did he, it's about lust and love. We say, did he really love her? And these kids, I mean, they're angry with this story. No.
Can they understand what's happening? Yes, and this is more than 2,000 years ago. This is a piece of the human condition.
Absolutely.
We recognize what we're seeing.
And we ask him, then we say, why do you say he did not love her? And you ought to hear these kids. And for many of them, they really begin to see the difference between love and lust. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is so clear.
And not to be trite, the man will say, if you loved me, you would. Mm-hmm. The woman should say, if you loved me, you would not.
Absolutely.
And that's what she's done.
Is there any consequence in the law of Moses to him for his act?
Yeah, death.
So,
death.
David superseded.
David had no wish to harm his son Amnon, whom he loved, because he was his firstborn. David was angry. What was he angry about? He was angry being put in this position.
Right.
Don't get, you haven't to read between the lines. The Bible does not spell this out for you, but you have the feeling that David's anger is not at Amnon as much as it is at the position that Amnon's put him in.
Is she liable to death too? Under the law of Moses in any way?
I don't think so. I don't think so. We are actually seeing in our world today, in India and in some of the Middle Eastern countries, we are seeing women killed in this position. So I think that the modern world might be.
You know, absolutely, just like with Tamar, through absolutely no fault of their own.
I believe that the law, such as it is, that is imposed upon them, would say just by being a woman, it's her fault. Mm-hmm. And I'm being ugly, but I think I'm also being accurate.
And when we do this in True Love Waits, we ask, did Tamar sin in any way? Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that probably 90% of the kids immediately say no. But there's always a few who say yes. And I'll say, why do you say that Tamar sinned? And they'll say, well, she had sex with him. And it's a great teachable moment. I mean, we go back, my translation here says, he violated her. Actually, I asked them, what evidence shows that she did not sin? And they all will tell you, no, she said, don't do it, stop. And he violates her, but it's such a teachable moment in there. I mean, it just relates to what he said. But we emphasize so strongly, she tried not to. She was violated, and she was not held responsible for her in his sin.
David was angry. What was he angry about? Mm-hmm. He seems to me to have been angry at being put in the situation. Mm-hmm. Because he does not want the consequences to fall on Amnon, and it's within his power to hold the consequences back. What is Absalom's response? We've already heard what he said to Tamar, verse 22.
He wouldn't speak to him.
He would not so much as speak to Amnon. He hated Amnon for having raped his sister Tamar. Okay, in my notes, that is section 1. And the title I have given to it is Lust to Loathing Among David's Children. The title to number 2, the section 2, there are 7 sections coming. The title of section 2 starts at the first 3 words of verse 23.
2 years later.
Mine says 2 years later. Mm-hmm. Okay, Naomi, did you have something you were going
to... Early on, Amnon asks that the king send Tamar. And David sends her.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Because
if you watch through here, that's one place. And I probably should have flagged that as well. There are several places where you see nothing's happening without the king's knowledge and permission. And it's almost funny to our ears.
Why? He requested that the sister be sent to him, and David obliged.
It's true.
Does that not seem...
Maybe he didn't think that was
going to happen. Well, if he assumes innocence on the part of the consequences, maybe not. But I do. The thing I'm flagging is not so much that as much as it is the idea that you can't do anything without the king's permission if you're among the king's children. So he doesn't seem to be having much to do with them, but he seems to be having an iron-fisted control over the day-to-day things. They seem to be having to get his permission for things that you and I would have thought, why would the king even need to be consulted? And I'm saying that's not the first time you're going to see that. You're going to see that several times as you go through the story.
Did David not learn anything with the dust up with Bathsheba and Uriah?
Apparently not.
Oh,
although I think from his standpoint, this would be pretty far afield. But I digress. The second section begins with 2 years later. I'd like you to take a look, please, at chapter 13, verse 38. At the end of section 2, the title for the next section is tail end of verse 38. 3 years after that. How long has gone by so far? We're only about halfway through the story. 5 years has gone by so far. So this thing is taking a while to play out. Would you please take a look at verse 28 of chapter 14. Try not to look at the context. Just look for
2 more years.
Right? Verse 1 of chapter 15 says, after this, but it doesn't give you a time. And verse 7 of chapter 15 says,
4 more years.
Okay, so we're looking at something.
40.
Chapter 15, verse 7. I guarantee it's 4. I understand. I have a footnote that says many translations will say 40, and it doesn't say, but that's a crock, but it has to be.
My note says that some manuscripts say 40.
Yeah, that's what mine says. But I think this is 4. What I'm saying is the total period of time is about a decade across which this story is coming out. It's approximately a decade across which all of this is coming out. So all of this festering, this poison within David's family, which David is doing nothing about. He's doing nothing about it. All that is just festering back in there. Okay, so here we are. I'm back to chapter 13, verse 23. You've sort of seen ahead to the breakpoints. 2 years later, we're now 2 years down the line, Absalom, it says, had the sheep shearers at Baal Hazor. Now, I want to help you with this a little bit if you can. That is an odd construction. The language is odd in that sense. It doesn't say he was shearing sheep. What does it say? It says he had the sheep shearers at, and it names the place. Now, how does yours render that? Does yours render that more or less that way?
He was shearing sheep.
Okay, here's my picture. What do you know about migrant workers?
The one who would know.
They go here and work, and then they go here and work, and then they go here and work, and then they go here. I have a picture that the sheep shearers were migrants, moving among the land-holding families in this area. So they would go here for a while, then they would go here, then they would go here, then they would go here. And it's his time to have the sheep shearing. And each time the sheep shearing would finish, just like it was back in the story of Boaz and Ruth, with barley harvest and things like that, when you finish that kind of thing, you have a party. And Absalom says, I'm going to have a feast. And he comes to the king. This, Naomi, is a flagging of another moment like this. Absalom went to the king and said, now, sir, your servant has the sheep shearers. See that phrase again. Will the king and his retinue be pleased to come with your servant, come to the party I'm going to have to celebrate? What's the king say?
No.
And at the end of the no, he says at first, I just don't want to be a burden to you. But what does he say at the end of it? Even though Absalom was insistent, what does the king do? What's the verb? What does it say? Yours says blessed. How interesting. Mine doesn't. Mine says it. He dismissed him. If dismissed is right.
He gave him a blessing. He said he was not willing to go instead of David.
Okay. Okay. Mine says he... Okay. In any event, the king's not going to go. But he implies it's okay for the rest of the family to go. Absalom persisted, at least let my brother Amnon come with us. And you can almost see the royal eyebrow going up. The king said, why should he go with you? But upon Absalom's insistence, he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Verse 28 is the most chilling verse in this part of Scripture. Premeditated murder by proxy.
Being 25, I think David realizes they all shouldn't be together in one place. All
you
of
sort
us
of
should not go and be present together.
Yeah, there's a hint. There's a hint of let's not have everybody together because if something happens, it could be bad.
Be conflict.
And you sort of remember Samson bringing down the big house and all the Philistine chiefs dying at one time.
Well, he repeats too what he just did with Amnon. Amnon came to him and said, "Can I go see Tamar?" And he said, "Go on."
Yeah.
So it's like whenever a son comes and asks
and that's, I'm flagging that, that there's
not,
the king's permission is needed for certain things.
And, you know, he would have known, going back to that story, that Amnon and Tamar, you know, oh, they love each other, you know. So he knew.
Well, at least Amnon thinks he
knows now that there's bad blood here, and it's still bruised.
Okay, verse 28, premeditated murder by proxy. Why don't I say that? Who's going to do the killing?
The servants.
And what does he say? Don't be afraid. I'm the one who gave the order. Boy, that's not going to protect them at all. if somebody wants to take vengeance. That won't protect them for a moment. But somehow Absalom's force of personality carries the day. Because it says in verse 29, in just a few words, Absalom's servants treated Amnon as Absalom had ordered. Treated him. What does treated him mean? Slaughtered him. Killed him. Okay? Now, let's get the picture. All the king's sons are there. How many sons are there? Six from Hebron, at least 9, 10, 11 from Jerusalem, and maybe more than that by now. Okay? How many Absaloms are there? One. Here's all these other sons, probably with their servants as well. So as soon as this murder happens, surely all the other sons and their servants will simply overpower these horrible attackers and save the day. What do they do? Well, they don't run. This is the next flag I would like to put down. They do not run. What do? They hop on their horses, right? King's sons have horses, right? No, they don't even hop on their horses. What do they hop on?
Mules.
How big is a mule? As big as a horse or bigger. What's my favorite mule? What's his name? I've told you on another day. His name was Jehoshaphat, and he carried us around. It was the most fun to ride that mule. It was great. Mules are big. Not necessarily fast, but they're steady. They all hopped on their... Every one of them had a mule, right? Probably the Avante edition. Probably it was a Mustang that they would have had, a Mustang mule or something like that. And they rode like crazy and fled. Am I okay? All right, verse 30. While they were on the road, word reached David. And what's the word that reached David? Absalom has killed all of the king's sons. Not one of them is left alive. That's a very specific word. Mm-hmm. Number one, these guys are fleeing for their lives on some of the fastest animals around. How did word get to David?
Faster.
You did your homework, right? You did read what I asked you to read, right? You did spot this little problem. How is the word getting faster than the fastest conveyance? How's that getting to David? And it's a very specific word. Not something's happened. It is all of your sons have been killed by Absalom. Not one is left alive. What did the king do? Tore his clothes and went into grief. Almost in the image of Tamar. All of his officers tore their clothes too. And then somebody spoke. Who spoke? Son of a gun? Who is this? This is Jonadab, that crafty, shrewd so-and-so. And what does he say?
He knows what's going on, evidently.
Oh, do not let my Lord take to heart the report that all the young men, all the king's sons have been killed. Only Amnon is dead. Absalom's been promising himself to do this since the day when Amnon raped his sister Tamar. How does he know that?
He knew about it.
He knew about it. Whoa. He was advising Amnon back here. Who's he advising now?
Absalom.
Now, wait a minute. You didn't see that, huh? What's the first report that came to the king? All of your sons are dead. The king is still digesting that when word comes, well, all of them are alive except one. What does the king do? He goes to the grief, deaths, and then what does he do? He comes 11/12 of the way out. That, folks, is by design. The king is being set up by who? By Jonadab, that crafty, shrewd SOG.
Do we get to hear more
son
about
of a gun.
Jonadab sins? Or is this the only two?
Three verses later, but don't go there quite yet.
Sorry.
Here's the thing. The word that came that they were all dead, where did that come from? Number one, we don't know. Where did it probably come from? Planted by Jonadab. We don't know that. The Bible doesn't reveal this. But what they've done is they've told the king a story that everybody's dead. And then, well, it's all but one, but look at what that one did. And what does that do? That mitigates the cold-blooded, premeditated murder that Absalom has just created, has just done. Okay, do not let my Lord take to heart this message. All the young men, all the king's sons have been killed. That's not what happened. Verse 33. My lord the king must not imagine that all the king's sons are dead. Only Amnon is dead. Man on sentry duty looked up and saw a large troop coming along the road. The sentry came to tell the king, I've seen some people coming down the road from the mountainside. And now Jonadab speaks again. What does he say? Those are the king's sons arriving. How does he know that? He doesn't, unless he has pre-knowledge. And David is being played like a harp. And I didn't choose those words idly. There is a master at work here. And as far as I can tell, he never gets his comeuppance. Jonadab is never called to account for this. David is being played successfully. He had scarcely finished speaking, Jonadab had, verse 36, when the king's sons arrived, wept aloud, the king and his retinue wept aloud too, and Absalom had fled. Where? To Tamai, the son of Amahub, king of Geshur. Now, before you go any further, let's just pause there for just a minute. Why did he go there? Why Geshur? If you go back and look, the mother of Absalom was the daughter of Tamai, son of Ahitub, the king of Geshur. He's gone to granddad. And it says in the last words of verse 37, what does it say?
David
mourned for his son every day.
It doesn't say which son.
It doesn't say which son. Does it? Doesn't say which son, does it? The one who's dead or the one who's gone? Verse 38, I took you to before because this is a punctuation. This is now the next section. Absalom had gone to Geshur. How long did he stay there?
3 years.
Verse 39, different words in different translations. Once the king got over, that's my words, Amnon's death, then his anger against Absalom subsided or faded. Those are the best two translations for that last verb that I know of. You may have other words in there, but those are the words that seem to me to catch it. Mm-hmm. Mine says he was consoled over Amnon's death. Enough time had gone by, he came to grips with that. Amnon was a rapist, and he had gotten vengeance by Absalom. So you sort of came to grips with that. And then his anger with Absalom faded or subsided. Those are the best two translations I know. And now, verse 1 of chapter 14. What does it say? Who steps into the picture now? And what do they tell you about Joab?
Son of.
So who is that Z guy? Who's that? What's his relationship to Joab?
His son, father.
That's his daddy, right? No, that's his mama.
Oh.
Very interesting. They name his mother here. You go over into Chronicles and look in the right place, what you find is, this is either Jesse's sister or the daughter of one of Jesse's brothers. Joab's part of the family. Okay. The young and the restless have nothing to do. This is complicated. I believe that they are naming Joab's mother. Check me out on this next week. If I'm wrong, I'll eat humble pie or crow or whatever I need to eat. Okay. He observed that the king was favorably inclined towards Absalom. Now, your translation will say other things. I'm hopeful that they will be more or less in line with that. Okay? And he therefore sent to Tekoa. Tekoa is the place where Amos later comes from. And what did he seek for in Tekoa? Who did he find?
A wise woman.
In the first hour, somebody in the front row said, one and the same. I thought that was a good line. Probably not all, but most. What did he say to her? Pretend to be in mourning. Go to the king, tell him this story, and when the king responds this way, as he will almost certainly respond this way, then say this. He sets her up with a script to read. What you read here is parallel to what Nathan did with these differences. Nathan himself came to David. Joab's not that courageous. He sends in a proxy. Nathan was coming in with a story to set David up to confront his own sin. Joab is setting this woman up with a story that will allow the king the freedom to absolve Absalom of his guilt for the sin.
Joab's still probably a little hesitant because he killed the other general, right? And you know David wasn't real happy with when he killed that other general.
Oh yeah.
So
he's taking a step.
The king might say, "Why did you kill that guy?" And I mourned for him.
So she tells the story. I've got two sons. One accidentally killed the other. Now they're seeking to execute that one for the murder. I'm going to have no sons left. And David says, okay, you know, you ought to get to keep your son. I'll pardon him. And then in verse 12 and 13, the woman says, please let me say something else. Go on. The king says, why has the king, who by giving this verdict has condemned himself, why has he thought up the idea against the judgment of God's people of not bringing home the son whom he has banished? This, in our translation up to now, it sounds like Absalom has run for his life. This implies that the king has banished him. And that implies a little bit more going on back in that earlier story. Does yours use the word banished? At the end of verse 14. It could be the king says, well, he's gone to Geshur, let him stay there. That could have been a way of reconciling the two parts of this. Okay? But the word banished is used, and that's a specific action for the king. Please make plans, she says in verse 14, for the king's banished son not to remain far away from him in exile. The king gives a very interesting reply in verse 19. What does he say in verse 19? I smell Joab. Now, that's not quite what it says, but you can see that, right? And the woman says, yeah, that's true. He told me everything I was to say. And then in verse 20, she says, your servant Joab did this to approach the matter indirectly, obliquely, but my Lord has the wisdom of the angel of God. He knows everything that happens on earth. Is that true? Good Lord, no. Jonadab has taken David and twisted his emotions and everything else like you wouldn't believe. And she's heaping the flattery on him. And he brings him back. Verse 21, king says to Joab, very well, the suit is granted. Go and bring the young man Absalom back. Joab fell on his face, prostrated himself, and blessed the king. My lord the king, that today your servant knows that he has won your favor, since the king has done what his servant asked. This is in light of your observation that Joab was probably not in the king's good graces because of what he did. Okay. Verse 24, my translation has the word however. However, the king did say that. What did the king say? Let him retire to his own house. He is not to appear in my presence. So Absalom retired to his own house and was not received by the king. Retired to his own house is a beautiful way of saying something that is much more blunt. House arrest. I don't want to see his face. I can go where I want to go. If he comes out of his house, I might see his face. I don't want to see his face. He's under house arrest.
Could be protected custody, too.
Well, that too. Okay? Now, verse 28 is the next break point. He lived for 2 years in Jerusalem without being received by the king, and he starts to do something about it. But we've skipped over three verses, verse 25, 26, 27. What does that tell you?
Well,
What do those three verses tell you? They fill you in on something. They say, first of all, Absalom himself is physically beautiful. They do not say handsome. They say beautiful. Interesting word to use. And they spend a whole lot of time talking about his hair. He let it grow for a year, then he cut it off, and my goodness, the thing weighed several pounds. Maybe I don't have the conversion for this, what 200 shekels is. And then the last verse tells you he actually has a family now in his house. How many sons does he have?
Three.
And given how long he's been gone, he's probably had those sons before he left. He also has a daughter whose name is?
Tamar.
Interesting. Interesting. And what does it say about the daughter?
She was beautiful.
She was beautiful. Mama, sister was beautiful. Daddy was beautiful. Daughter's beautiful. Beautiful people. He lived in Jerusalem for 2 years. He summoned Joab, intending to send him to the king. Mine says he summoned Joab. Yours may say he sent for Joab. What does that tell you about the power relationship as Absalom sees it? Absalom has power. What does Joab do? Ignores him. He sends for him again, summons him again. Joab ignores him a second time. Third time doesn't come. Absalom just has Joab's fields set on fire. Joab comes in and says, "What are you doing?" And Absalom says, "I'm trying to get you to pay attention to me. I want you to go to the king and get me back into the king's good graces." Joab went to the king in verse 33, told him this. The king summoned Absalom, who prostrated himself with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. What has happened? He's been restored, forgiven, freed from all the consequences of what he's done. Now that's the point where we're going to have to stop. I told the first hour, I told you at the beginning of this hour, I'm looking through here and I don't see theological high spots. I don't see verses that we commit to memory and they guide us in ways that we seem to be able to do in lots of places in Scripture. But this is a backdrop against which some pretty big things are coming. So I commend again to you, read the rest of the book. Read the rest of the book. See where this story goes. Keep an eye on Rabbah of the Ammonites. Keep an eye on Jonadab. We've already taken that flag down.
Okay.
Keep an eye on the mules, the modes of transportation. Right? Was there something else? Keep an eye on the times the king seems to give permission for his children to do this or to do that. When the children come to him to ask permission, he just sort of freely gives it. Okay? Let's have a brief word of prayer. Father, this morning we've been in some places in the Bible that seem to be so ugly. But we recognize without even looking very hard that all the things that are being described here are still alive and well in our world. The ugliness and the sin that seems to so easily overtake people back then and now seem to be so similar. We pray that you would give us a sense of your presence, a sense of your values, a sense of your views, that would keep us seeing things the way you see things and therefore doing things the way you would do them. For we ask this in Jesus' name.